Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. The long-lasting legacy of the United States nuclear testing on the Marshall Islands is one of the most undercovered stories in the United States. Between 1946 and 1958, the U.S. detonated 67 nuclear bombs on, in, and above the small nation of the Marshall Islands in the Pacific Ocean, vaporizing whole islands, carving craters into shallow lagoons, and exiling hundreds of people from their homes. Many people were exposed to radiation, relocated, told it was safe to go back home, and then evacuated again. The United States also dumped 3 million cubic feet of radioactive waste within a bomb crater that was capped with an 18-inch thick cover and conducted a dozen biological weapons tests, including experiments with aerosolized bacteria. Today's guest, LA Times reporter Suzanne Rust and her colleague photographer Carolyn Cole, visited the Marshall Islands twice over 15 months to tell this undercovered story. They worked on the project with Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. They reviewed thousands of documents and interviewed U.S. and Marshallese officials. Their initial plan was to focus on the lingering legacy of U.S. nuclear testing. But once they saw algae blooms on a snorkeling trip, along with fish kills, they had to reassess. And they asked themselves a very important question. Would radiation matter in a generation if the Marshall Islands were enveloped by rising sea levels and lagoons cooked by climate change? Joining us to talk about this incredible investigation is Suzanne Rust, an investigative reporter with the Los Angeles Times, where she specializes in environmental issues. Suzanne is former editor of Columbia University's Energy and Environmental Reporting Project, where she oversaw several projects, including a series that examined ExxonMobil's understanding of climate science in the 80s, the 90s, and the early 2000s. And you can find Suzanne's work, including a number of the pieces she wrote about the Marshall Islands, at yourcallradio.org. And Suzanne joins us via Skype from Menlo Park, California. Hi, Suzanne. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for this incredible investigation. As I said, you and Carolyn each took two trips to the Marshall Islands over 15 months, and you traveled there to observe a team of Columbia University researchers who were evaluating radiation levels in the northern atolls. How did you connect with that team?
So I connected with them while I was still at Columbia University. They went to an institute called the Brown Institute, whose sort of premise is to hook up Columbia journalists with Stanford engineers and do a big project on some sort of monumental worldwide issue. And this team from Columbia had gone to them to find out how to do this. They ended up not getting funded by the Brown Institute, but the Brown Institute hooked the two of us up since we were all at Columbia. And that's how I met them and incredibly learned about this story. And just to sort of pause here, I think, you know, what was so amazing to me was how little I knew about what had happened in the Marshall Islands. And as they described what had happened in the Cold War, I realized I'm a fairly well-educated person. I don't know about this. I'm guessing most people don't know about it. And that's sort of what started then the investigation.
Yeah, I'm with you because, I mean, my mouth dropped as I read your pieces. There's just so much in here. And I was wondering how much you knew about the Marshall Islands before this project. But it sounds like you also didn't know that much. You also point out in the story that this is, for those of us who grew up in California, this is not something we learn about in school.
Oh, yeah, absolutely not. And I actually grew up in New York, and I didn't learn about this. It was funny, while I was doing the reporting on this, again, I sort of had this recognition that I didn't know anything about this, right? I was appalled by it, which is why I went to see what, I went down to the San Jose's public library, where they have all the textbooks that are California education approved on the shelves. I just wanted to see if I had missed anything while I was in high school. I even wrote my AP American History English teacher to find out if she had taught us this. She had not.
Wow.
So, it's a gaping hole in, I think, most Americans' education.
Well, since so many of us don't know about this, let's just go over a few basic facts about the Marshall Islands. So they're 5,000 miles west of Los Angeles, about 500 miles north of the equator. There's only one flight that goes to the Marshall Islands on a daily basis. How long does it take to get there?
So from California, you have to fly to Hawaii, and the flight to the Marshall Islands is, I think, it leaves at about 7 a.m. So you have to spend a night in Honolulu, and then it's about a six-hour flight to Majuro. And then from there, it goes from Majuro, which is the most populous island in an atoll within the Marshall Islands, to Kwajalein, where there is a U.S. Army base, which is also in the Marshall Islands. And then from there, it goes to Micronesia and eventually ends up in Guam.
You write that the Marshall Islands atolls are the remnants of ancient volcanoes that once protruded from the seas. They were settled 3,000 years ago by the ancestors of present-day Marshallese who crossed the ocean on boats from Asia and Polynesia. And for American officials in the mid-1940s, this 750,000 square mile expanse of ocean must have seemed like a near perfect spot to test their growing atomic arsenal. So as you write, this is about five times larger than the state of California.
Yeah, it's a crazy amount of area. But there are 29 atolls within the Marshall Islands, and they're just sort of these slivers, again, sort of around where these ancient volcanoes once protruded up out of the oceans. They then, over time, sank back down. So you just have the rings around where some of these giant volcanoes were, and that's where the people live today, sort of on these coral rings that sort of formed up over the base of the volcano. So it's crazy. You fly there, and it's just a seascape. It's blue, 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 and then you see almost like a necklace of sand, right, in a circle, and that's where the Marshallese found land 3,000 years ago and, you know, lived peacefully until first the Germans, then the Japanese, and finally the Americans came.
And to that point, I think this quote from Autumn Bordner, a former researcher at Columbia University's K equals one project, which focuses on the legacy of nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands. I mean, this says so much. Quote, the Marshall Islands were selected as ground zero for nuclear testing precisely because colonial narratives portrayed the islands as small, remote, and unimportant.
Yeah. So you see that when you go and start looking through the literature, the news back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you see over and over and over again this description of the Marshall Islands as an unpopulated place. They'll occasionally talk about natives who live there, but it's so clear the Western view of this place was remote and unpopulated and a place to be, you know, tested upon without any recourse to Western-minded people.
And you actually uncovered some pretty nasty and racist quotes from U.S. government officials about natives, and we'll read those throughout the show. But before we do that, so let's just talk about what happened here. 67 nuclear bombs the United States detonated between 1946 and 1958 left widespread contamination on these islands. Now, as you write, although the U.S. conducted only 6% of its nuclear bomb testing on the Marshall Islands, the detonations and the mushroom clouds generated more than half of the total energy yield from all U.S. testing. So first of all, can we talk about what is the history behind this? Why did the United States decide to detonate these bombs on these islands?
Well, again, they wanted to detonate these bombs in a place where they weren't going to get much pushback from anybody. So they did have a Nevada testing site. They did explode bombs in the United States in a desert sort of area. But there was so much pushback on that from people who lived downwind, who lived around, that they sort of limited what they could do. So in terms of the size, in terms of the magnitude. So they went to this Pacific Island nation and did this out there, figuring they could try as big a bomb as they could create and see what happened. And what they did over the course of this 12 years was see what happened when you blew up a bomb in the water, what happens when you do it on land, what happens when you do it up in the air. And they tried all different sizes. They tried different triggers. They just kind of went bananas out there.
How many people were living on the islands at that time?
It was in the hundreds. So in Eniwetok Atoll, which is where I sort of centered, sort of anchored my most recent story, I think there were maybe 200 plus people living there at the time that the U.S. went in.
And so what explains the fact that although the U.S. conducted 6% of its nuclear bomb testing on the Marshall Islands, the detonations and the mushroom clouds generated more than half of the total energy yield from all U.S. testing?
So it was the size of the bombs. So over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we dropped, I think it was a 15 kiloton bomb. And you know, we all know from history how devastating that was. What they did in the Marshall Islands was they sort of upped the ante. And instead of just using your plain old atomic bomb, which, you know, destroys some weapons, destroys a bomb. They used a hydrogen bomb. And those have a much larger explosive fallout, right? These are not measured in kilotons. They're measured in megatons. And you use an atomic trigger to then blow up the hydrogen bomb, right? So it's this incredible amount of power. And they blew up this one bomb called Castle Bravo that was 1,000 times larger than what had blown up over Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And that was just one of them. The Mike shot, which was the first hydrogen bomb that was exploded, was about, 10.4 megatons as opposed to 15 kilotons. So you can sort of see the scale of the bombs that they were blowing up in the Marshall Islands was just so much greater than what they had done elsewhere.
In one of the pieces you wrote, you cited a peer-reviewed study by Columbia University, and researchers there report that soil on four isles of the Marshall Islands contains concentrations of nuclear isotopes that greatly exceed those found near the Chernobyl and Fukushima nuclear power plants. On one isle, those levels are reported to be 1,000 times higher.
Yeah, so clearly at the time, right, there was concern about among the people who lived there, the Marshallese, about radiation. But over time, the U.S. kept saying, you know, don't worry about this. We've cleaned it up. It's not a problem. And even up until very recently, they've said it's really people should be moving back to the atolls that they left, you know, 40, 50, 60 years ago, because radiation isn't that bad. What the Columbia University researchers wanted to do was to evaluate that. Is it really actually okay to get back to these atolls? And in some of these islands, it is clearly not. People should not be spending any amount of time, or certainly not eating food off of these islands.
And since you brought up Castle Bravo, again, that was detonated on the morning of March 1st, 1954. It was 1,000 times more powerful than the bombs dropped on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And Suzanne, the other part of the pieces that you worked on, just the people that you interviewed. Is it Nerje Joseph?
Yes.
So she's 72, and she was a witness to that Castle Bravo detonation. She was only 7 years old at the time.
Yep. So she was a young girl who lived on an atoll called Rongelap, which was about 100 miles east of where Bikini Atoll was, which is where they blew up Castle Bravo. And so all the people on Rongelap on March 1st, 1954, had no idea what was happening. They would hear explosions. They kind of had an idea that the U.S. was around, but nobody had come and warned them that this was going to be detonating. And just to take it even a step back from there, the morning that the U.S. blew this bomb up, which I actually don't think is in the story. It might be in one of the earlier stories they had done during the year. The National Weather Service had told them that there were going to be easterly moving winds. And the U.S. decided to ignore that and still blew up this bomb, knowing that the fallout would travel east over these populated islands. Nevertheless, the morning of March 1st, there were, I think it was about 80 plus people on the atoll of Rongelap. They woke up in the morning and, as Nerje said, saw two suns that morning. There was the one sun coming up as it does every morning in the east. And then for a brief period, there was something that looked like the sun in the western horizon, and that was the Castle Bravo bomb. And several hours later, the winds carried the fallout over her island and dropped it down. The people didn't know what it was. It looked like snow. They ran out and they touched it. The children caught it on their tongues, fell into their cisterns, covered their food. And for 2 days, these people were repeatedly exposed by this fallout, drinking water that was contaminated and had not been evacuated or told not to touch anything and stay indoors and, you know, lock anything they could.
And Nerje Joseph told you, and then also according to government documents, U.S. authorities came to evacuate them 2 days later. So a full 2 days went by. And by that time, as you report, some people were beginning to suffer from acute radiation poisoning. Their hair was falling out in clumps, their skin was burning, and they were vomiting.
That's correct. And so finally, 2 days later, again, you know, the U.S. had gotten the, you know, they had several observers. They'd gotten their observers out of harm's way. They did not move the people from Rongelap. So 2 days later, they came and took them away. And then according to records, they started something called Project 4.1, where they then studied these people for the next 40, 50 years, taking blood for them, taking their thyroids, testing their tissue. And they also started a control group. So people who were from that atoll who weren't on the atoll that day. And never told the Marshallese about this. So they were doing, you know, human population studies without informing people on the effects of radiation.
And 3 years after this happened, the authorities encouraged this woman, her family, and her neighbors to actually go back.
That is correct. So encouraged them to go back. They knew that the island was still radioactive. They had done tests, but they figured it was better than keeping the people on the island where they'd been evacuated to. And I think the quote that they used was because the people were becoming indolent and taking too much in terms of handouts. So they decided it was better to send the people back to their island and have them live out there. Meanwhile, they were continuing to do these nuclear tests 100 miles offshore. So they would see, like, through, they would come and test the people who were on Rongelap. They'd test their blood and their tissue, and they would see spikes of radiation go up as they did tests.
You have this amazing photo of Nerje Joseph, again, 72 now. She was 7 years old when the U.S. detonated its largest nuclear bomb. What struck you when you talked to her?
Number one, she was such a lovely, kind, warm person, right? She was not, I was nervous talking to people who had been through this, because here I am, an American, coming down and taking their time, right? It was, you know, just sort of putting myself in their way, just as the Americans had done in the 40s and 50s. But she was lovely. She was articulate. She was really, again, felt very strongly about telling the story, because she and the survivors of this are getting very old. They're not going to be around in 20 or 30 years, and they don't want this story to die with them. So she was totally accommodating. But the other thing that struck me was just thinking about her life, where at the age of seven, this happened to her. She was removed from her island. And every year for the rest of her life, she has either been tested in the Marshall Islands by Americans or sent to Hawaii for a test. Wow. And just what that must feel like as a person to know you're a test subject like that.
Was
striking.
What do these tests reveal? I mean, you have this one incredible video about these beautiful singers in the Marshall Islands who are starting to lose their voices, and they believe it's connected to the radiation. So what do these tests reveal?
So the tests reveal a number of things. They show sort of the radiation burden in many of these people's bodies that has really dropped, because they're not living on these islands anymore. So they're not eating the foods that are laced with radioactivity. Ali Raj, who was at Columbia with me, I had hired him as a reporter for my group there. He was the one who really looked into this thyroid issue. He's a trained musician, and music is his passion. And when he started hearing that there were Marshallese who as a result of their radiation contamination, had thyroid disorders and therefore lost their voices, that really struck a chord with him. The Marshallese also, for, you know, hundreds and thousands of years, had sort of carried on their culture through song. So what sort of happened is, as these people's thyroids have become diseased and they haven't been able to sing, that culture hasn't passed on in a way that it always had. I mean, clearly there are other influences there, but this was sort of a very direct sort of effect of the American testing program on the voices of Marshallese.
Today, we're speaking with Suzanne Rust, an investigative reporter with the Los Angeles Times, where she specializes in environmental issues. And she and her colleague, photographer Carolyn Cole, visited the Marshall Islands over the course of 15 months to tell this undercovered story. Between 1946 and 1958, the U.S. detonated 67 nuclear bombs on, in, and above the small nation of the Marshall Islands in the Pacific Ocean. And I hope you can take time to read their incredible reporting. There's videos there with some of the singers and just beautiful photographs. So let's talk about how the U.S. government saw all of this and testing actual human beings. You write that 3 years after the Castle Bravo bomb, U.S. government documents from that time show officials weighed the potential hazard of radiation exposure against, quote, the current low morale of the natives and risk of an onset of indolence. Ultimately, they decided to go forward with the resettlement so researchers could study the effects of lingering radiation on human beings. So tell us what those documents revealed.
Again, they sort of revealed this. I think Autumn Bordner best sort of put it, this very sort of colonial sort of view of these people, right? That they were literally just sort of test subjects to them. There's one quote in the story from a guy named Merrill Eisenberg, who I believe was on the Atomic Energy Commission's scientific review panel. And he sort of summed it up as, you know, this is an incredible opportunity for the United States to study the effects of radiation on, as he put it, you know, the not Westerners so much, but not mice, sort of something in between, and would be really revealing.
Suzanne, I was struck by this quote, so I'll just read it. I'm looking at your piece right now. He says, and this was in 1956, while it's true that these people do not live the way that Westerners do, civilized people, it is nonetheless also true that they are more like us than the mice.
Yeah. So I think that best sort of describes what they thought about the Marshallese, how they viewed this. I mean, it was, you know, from the physics, from the military side, from the medical side, this was just an experimental playground. And that's how they viewed the Marshall Islands and the Marshallese.
You write that cancer cases, miscarriages, and deformities multiplied. 10 years after that, in 1967, 17 of the 19 children who were younger than 10 and on the island the day Bravo exploded have developed thyroid disorders and growths, and one child actually died of leukemia.
Yeah, it was devastating. So these people had been moved back 3 years after they had been evacuated off of Rongelot. And the United States government knew the islands still had radioactivity on them. And the people moved back and kept eating food, you know, that was grown in radioactive soil. So the coconuts were radioactive, the fish were radioactive, the pandanus. And, you know, as the children who are growing and have small body sizes were ingesting this, it affected their bodies. So they got thyroid cancer, and one boy at the age of 18 died of leukemia. I mean, it's horrific. The women talk about this period of time. They remember their mothers who had miscarriages. And there's actually a term that these many of these women called their miscarriages, which were jelly babies. They were born with no bones. It's really, truly horrific.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're speaking today with Suzanne Rust, an investigative reporter with the Los Angeles Times, where she specializes in environmental issues. And she and her colleague, photographer Carolyn Cole, visited the Marshall Islands over 15 months to tell this undercovered story. They worked on the project with Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. And I hope you can take the time to read the pieces, watch the videos, and take a look at the photographs. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today is our One Planet series, and we are joined by LA Times reporter Suzanne Rust. She is out with a number of incredible pieces about the United States nuclear tests on the Marshall Islands. Between 1946 and 1958, the U.S. detonated 67 nuclear bombs on, in, and above the small nation of the Marshall Islands. The people there are still calling for justice, and we'll talk about actually where that radioactive waste is now and what could potentially happen with sea level rise, because the Marshall Islands are getting so much attention at the United Nations because of sea level rise. And before we do that, Suzanne, Eleanor from San Francisco, she couldn't stay on the line, but she wanted to know how you conducted your research and how the LA Times is continuing to support this work.
So our research was basically done going through archives of government records. You can find several of them online. Clearly talking to sources, flying to the Marshall Islands, meeting people there. The National Nuclear Commission of the Marshall Islands also has a database of documents that they have collected. I have to say, one of the more upsetting and appalling things I sort of learned as I was reporting on this is how much of the information is still classified. So one of the things the Marshall Islands did unknowingly sort of entered into a contract in the 1980s with the United States, which sort of released the United States of any future obligation to remediate or clean up or pay compensation for the nuclear mess it left behind. But as I discovered, the Marshallese don't know so much of what actually happened there. For instance, we learned that there was a biological weapons testing that happened there in the 1960s when the Marshall Islands government signed this compact with the United States. They were completely unaware. So in any case, I did the research I could with the documents that were available, but there is still a lot that's classified and unknown.
So tell us more about the government of the Marshall Islands, and why did they agree to this?
I think they had been through, at this point, 20 to 30 years of many of their people not able to return to their homeland. They were looking for help getting those people back to their islands. They were looking for help to, you know, keep their government going. Many of these people who had been evacuated and were now living on different islands were being held sort of fed by the United States. I mean, they had been sent to islands where there was no lagoon, or the lagoon was so much smaller than what they had been accustomed to that they couldn't get the food that they had subsidized themselves with before. So the United States was paying for food. So the Marshall Islands just wanted to sort of move on and pass this. They wanted to become a sovereign nation, and they believed that the United States was being forthright with them with the information that was provided about what had been left behind. So they signed this compact. They received $150 million in return from the United States, and they received the right to work in the United States. So they have visas that allow them to come here and work, unlike other immigrant populations. And that all seemed like a really good deal at the time.
Hmm. Well, let's go to a caller, and thanks for that question. Let's hear from Sean in San Francisco. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the show.
Hi, and I am a first-time caller, although a long-time listener.
Oh, thank you.
My father was stationed in the Marshall Islands during World War II. He was a Seabee, and one of the things that he did was to free dive and put dynamite charges onto the coral reef in order to get them out of the way for ships coming in. The island that he was on was unpopulated, but they imported Marshallese from some of the populated islands to come and work, you know, doing menial chores for the Seabees. He brought back a number of pictures, you know, these little tiny square ones that came from World War II. And as a kid, I was absolutely appalled at the comments on the back of the pictures. I'm not sure whether he wrote them or whether somebody else wrote them, but it was mostly pictures of half-naked women in grass skirts and with very racist, very sexual comments. And my father was not that kind of guy, and my mother was certainly not that kind of guy, yet the stayed in the collection of photos that we had. And so I'm just speaking to the fact that what you were talking about is that they were not considered human.
Right. You know, thank you so much for calling in, Sean. Do you remember any stories your father shared about his time there? Oh, did we cut Sean off? Sean, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay. Yep. Do you remember any stories that your dad shared with you?
Well, as I got older, I asked him about these photos, and he sort of ignored it. And he said, hey, nobody paid any attention to them. You know, they were all a bunch of lazy slobs and so forth. That was about it.
Wow.
You know, and it just, you know, I had a lot of problems with my father's racism. But
yeah.
That was one of the very early ones. But no, he didn't say much about it. Although when I asked him, when I interviewed him and my mother for a video, and I asked him about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he snaps back really quickly. We had to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So he was totally in favor of the nuclear program, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing that story, Sean. Thank you for calling in. So what about that, Suzanne? I mean, this is... You know, you don't spend too much time talking about the racism and the colonial mindset. But, I mean, you know, when you think about just the history of the United States, and then you think about just what the U.S. did in so many countries around the world, and that colonial mindset ran very, very deep.
Oh, it ran very deep, and it still runs today.
Yeah,
I think one of the things, I'm not sure Ali brought it up in his story, and it was a section that I had put in, but we edited it out. If you go to the Marshall Islands today, you can see sort of the colonial setup really blatantly. There's an island called Kwajalein where there's a U.S. Army base, and you land on it, you almost feel like you're in California. There are these, you know, very nice sturdy ranch houses along palm-lined streets. People ride their bicycle everywhere. There's a supermarket, bowling alley, you know, a very sort of typically American kind of island. Right offshore, a 10-minute ferry ride is Ibai Island, and it's considered the ghetto of the Pacific. It is, I think, the third or fourth most densely populated island in the world. I think there's something like 20,000 people living on a square quarter mile. There's leprosy on the island, tuberculosis, all sorts of issues. Most of the people, the biggest employer of the people on Ibai is the U.S. Army base right across the way. And so you see this you feel like you've almost walked back into an imperial time where there is one class of Westerners, of, you know, quote unquote, civilized folks, and then the people who serve them, who are the brown people who live on the island next door. It is really striking and appalling, to say the very least. And as I've discovered, this is not atypical for many Pacific islands.
Yeah. Let's talk about where the waste is located. The Runit Dome holds more than 3.1 million cubic feet of U.S.-produced radioactive soil and debris, including lethal amounts of plutonium. This is about 35 Olympic-sized swimming pools.
Yeah. So on Eniwetok, where they detonated 43 atomic bombs, before bringing the island back to the people who had lived there, the Dry Eniwetok and Dry Njebi, the U.S. said it would clean up the atoll. So it went through and took up sort of the most radioactive soil, picked up the debris, and then dumped it all within this bomb crater that was on an island called Runit. They didn't line the crater. They just threw everything in there and mixed it with cement, and then they capped it with this concrete cap and left. And even at the time, I think it was 1980 when it was finally finished, scientists and engineers were saying that the dome, as it's called, was leaking. So groundwater underneath the dome was contaminated with the plutonium and other radioactive contaminants that were in it, and then leaching out into the lagoon. As sea level is rising, that I think they call it the communication of the groundwater with the lagoon is also increasing. And the dome is actually going up and down with the tide. So it increases, it goes high, like elevates when the tide comes in, and then it goes down when the tide comes out. And we walked around it, Carolyn Cole and I, and it is cracking. There is foliage that's snaking up the side. I mean, it's been sitting under, you know, the equatorial sun for 40 years now. And it's starting to weather and crack. And The real concern, the Department of Energy reported earlier this spring at a talk in Majuro, the real concern is things like typhoons and bigger storm waves, that they're actually going to break open this dome. And if that happens, you will have large pieces of debris and contaminated concrete that can wash up on the shore, not just of this atoll, but can actually escape the lagoon and get out into the wider Pacific.
Well, this is so concerning because, you know, your initial plan was to focus on the legacy of U.S. nuclear testing. But then when you went snorkeling, you saw these algae blooms, there were fish kills, and that made you kind of reassess and say, you know, what would radiation matter in a generation if the islands were enveloped by rising sea levels?
It really was. One of those points that I think happens to many reporters when they're working on something long term. You know, I went out to do one thing and learned something else. And really sort of after this day, Carolyn and I were snorkeling and scuba diving, and the water was hot. I mean, it wasn't comfortable to be in. We got back.
Suzanne, can I ask you about that? Because you quoted someone in your piece who said they couldn't actually put their feet in the water because it was so hot. And, you know, those of us who live on the California coast, we don't go in the ocean because it's so cold. So it's hard to even imagine not being able to go in the ocean because it's so hot. Can you explain what that was like?
This day that we went in, I think the surface temperature of the water was something like 92 or 94 degrees. I mean, it was hot. And yeah, so we went on to Bikini Island. We met with a man who worked there, Dick Dickey Jr. And he had been, I think this was his second or third day on the island. His grandparents had lived on Bikini Island and had been evacuated during the Cold War when this testing happened. So here he was coming back to his ancestors' homeland to be a contractor for the Department of Energy. On his first day, it was so hot, he said, he went into the ocean side of the island to cool off, and he couldn't cool off because the water was so hot. But he also noticed that there were dead fish hitting his ankles as he was standing in there. So Carolyn and I asked to see where he had stood that day. And when we got to the ocean side of the island, there was a line of black fish just as far as you could see along the tide line that had washed up on the shore. I mean, literally cooked in the water out there. It was appalling. So we got back later that day to the ship, really distressed about what we had seen. The coral was dead. We had went with a Stanford University researcher who 2 years before had been to the lagoon studying corals. And we were scuba diving with her, you know, watching her and helping her out a bit. And she couldn't find the corals that she had marked and logged their GPS coordinates 2 years before. They were all dead now. Mm. So we got to the end of this trip we were on thinking the nuclear issue is a real concern, but are these islands even going to be here in 2 years? Is there going to be anything to eat in the lagoon? How are people going to live? What we eventually came to understand by speaking to the Marshallese is that these two issues are not separate for them. They're one and the same. These are both legacies of a world that they didn't belong to or live in that are washing up on their shores and affecting them directly.
We're talking today with Suzanne Rust, an investigative reporter with the Los Angeles Times, where she specializes in environmental issues. And she and her colleague, photographer Carolyn Cole, visited the Marshall Islands over 15 months to tell this undercovered story. And it is so important. Between 1946 and 1958, the U.S. detonated 67 nuclear bombs on, in, and above the small nation of the Marshall Islands in the Pacific Ocean. And so we've been talking about this dome that holds all this waste and what's going to happen with more sea level rise. Because based on forecasts by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, sea levels could rise 4 to 5 feet by the end of the century, which would submerge most of the Marshall Islands. Let's hear from another caller. Let's go to Hal in Berkeley. Hi, Hal. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I had a question. First, I wanted to say that's really terrible what happened to the Marshallese. Yep. My question is a little bit more personal. I was there in late 1961 for about a month working for General Electric, which was a time when they were testing intercontinental ballistic missiles that were fired from California. I was on the atoll of Eniwetok. And they told us before we went there that there was no danger anymore. So this was 3 years after. So my question is, was that really true?
Was what really true?
True that it was not dangerous anymore in terms of radioactivity?
No. So clearly the Columbia University researchers have gone around and they have found that there is still radioactivity on many of these islands. But that was the Columbia researchers who went out in 2018 went out after the soil had been removed by the U.S. Army, the soil that was considered radioactive. They didn't do that until the late 1970s. So when you were there in the 1960s, 1961, there was still quite a lot of radioactivity in the soil.
Oh, thank you very much. It's bad news, but better to know the truth.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Hal. And since you were talking about what happened in California, Suzanne, you write that, let's see, between 1948 and 1958, the U.S. military detonated 43 atomic bombs. After agreeing to a 1958 temporary moratorium on nuclear testing with the U.K. and the Soviet Union, the U.S. began using the atoll as a conventional and bioweapons testing ground. For the next 18 years, the U.S. shot ballistic missiles at it from California?
Yes, they did. And just to sort of bring you up to date, we still do that, except now we send them to Kwajalein, no longer to Eniwetok. But yes, we shot ballistic missiles at the atoll. We apparently sent monkeys out on some of the islands and then gassed them with lethal bacteria. Again, it was a playground for weapons testing.
Okay, so let's talk about the U.S. government here. I mean, based on your reporting, it's not taking any responsibility for what is happening to this dome and the waste that's being stored in this structure.
So what the U.S. government says right now is that it is not their responsibility. This is a dome. This is a structure that is on Marshallese land, and therefore it belongs to the Marshallese. They point to this compact that they signed in 1986 that said that they had no more responsibility for the nuclear legacy in the Marshall Islands. So that they will refer to this compact. However, the Department of Energy does go out and periodically test groundwater, or they're going to begin testing groundwater around the dome. However, their line right now is that, let's say that the dome does collapse and fall in and we find that there's a lot of radioactivity leaking out of the dome, it's not a big deal because the lagoon itself is so contaminated that any addition from the dome will be minimal in comparison with the contamination already in the lagoon.
And the people basically say, we didn't put this nuclear waste here. This is not ours. The United States government needs to deal with this. I mean, for decades, they've been calling for the U.S. government to deal with this.
Yeah, so you're exactly right. They don't feel like this is their waste. They don't want it there. They don't know why they have to suffer the effects from it. What's interesting right now, again, I keep referring to this 1986 compact, that every so often has been renewed. In 2023, the compact will be renewed again. It wasn't clear that it was going to be renewed just 6-7 months ago, but this summer, Michael Pompeo flew out to Micronesia and told the Marshallese the U.S. was interested in extending the compact again. The Marshallese finally feel like they have some weight coming with these negotiations, that there is this, they sort of are on an international stage right now because they are so visible in terms of the climate issues. Everybody is aware that sea level rise is going to impact the Marshall Islands as one of its, you know, first real devastating places, right? I mean, it's the sea level is rising. It may go over these islands. And so people are aware of that. They're also right now, there are elections that started yesterday. I think they're closed now in the Marshall Islands, but But throughout Micronesia, which had always generally been sort of U.S. sympathetic, the Chinese have really made inroads. And so the Solomon Islands and Kiribati recently renounced Taiwan, which they'd had diplomatic relations with, and instead embraced mainland China. The Marshallese are considering that right now. Half the parliament would rather have diplomatic ties with China than the Taiwanese. And the United States is rightfully really concerned about it. So all of that to say, as they go into negotiations, the Marshallese may finally have the weight they need to get something done.
What about some sort of compensation? You report that the Nuclear Claims Tribal, which is an independent arbiter established by the U.S. Marshall Islands Compact, has ruled in their favor, awarding them more than $2 billion in damages, but the U.S. has paid out only $4 million, according to congressional testimony.
So, yes. Again, after this compact was made in 1986, the two nations together created this international court called the Nuclear Claims Tribunal. And the idea behind that was that Marshallese could come and make property and health claims to the tribunal. The tribunal ruled that the Marshallese has ruled in favor of $2 billion worth of claims. The United States hasn't honored that tribunal. It has only paid out $4 million. And so part of what the Marshallese are pushing for right now, again, I talked about this National Nuclear Commission that they have. They came out with a national nuclear strategy, which is to finally get that compensation that they feel like they are owed, and which the United States has said over and over again, we paid you $150 million in 1986, we're done. So again, as these negotiations go underway for this 2023 compact, we'll see if that compensation finally comes to play out for the Marshallese.
And we talked earlier about Nerje Joseph, and you write that, you know, she lived in this gorgeous area. I mean, even the photos that you have on your piece are just so beautiful. There's just pristine blue water. And actually, before I ask you about Nerje and how you ended your story, you know, what was it like to be there? How did it feel? I mean, just given the history of the place, what was it like?
Well, it's beautiful and haunting. Mm-hmm. So you are in a place like Eniwetok, not so much Eniwetok. There are people who live on the island of Eniwetok, but most of the atoll nobody lives. Certainly in Rongelap and Bikini, there's nobody there. So we were on a boat with Columbia University researchers for 3 weeks in these atolls. You didn't see planes fly overhead. There was no boat noise. It really now is this place that the United States talked about in the 1940s, which it wasn't in the 1940s, but now it is. There is nobody there. It is one of the few places on the planet where you don't hear people. However, it doesn't take long before you see the signs of the Cold War. There are bunkers hidden behind vines and trees on the islands. There's twisted rebar as you go scuba diving below. In Bikini Atoll, there are sunken ships that were blown up by the atomic testing program. So again, it's exquisitely remote now and beautiful, but at the same time, you can't escape why it is that way.
In your piece, when you write about Nerje Joseph, she says, when she lived on Rongelap, we had a oneness. We worked together, we ate together, we played together. And that has been lost. And you end your piece with a quote from her. You know, basically, she says that she wants to go home. She wants to live in a place that is safe and secure. She says one day she hopes her children, her grandchildren, and great grandchildren can return to her ancestral home in Rongelap, and she could be buried in the sands of her youth alongside her ancestors under the coconut trees that she remembers so well.
So part of Marshallese culture is based on land, right? I mean, as we talked about it, 750,000 square miles of ocean with these little like islets, thin strips of coral atoll that the people claimed. The land is so important to them. It's their footing. It's their anchor. And having taken that away from them is devastating for people whose identity is placed in the land that their ancestors lived. It's really moving and so upsetting to hear people talk. It's like a piece of them has been taken away when you've taken a piece of their land. It's what they believe. So it is devastating. And they're also, again, sort of circling back to the beginning of our conversation, they are so struck by how few Americans know their story. Mm-hmm. And so Nerjay at the end says, you know, you guys in Los Angeles, you make movies about everything. Why don't you talk about us?
Well, I'm so grateful that you've done this piece, Suzanne, you and your colleagues. And we have about a minute left. What kind of reaction have you received? I know on social media it got a lot of attention, but what are you hearing from people?
Generally, you know, almost everybody I've heard from has a story, whether they're Marshallese, whether they're Hawaiian and they knew what was happening there and they feel like a connection with what happened, or they're military. I mean, it is amazing how many people, how many servicemen worked in these areas and did not know what had happened and have come home and have all sorts of maladies that the U.S. government won't recognize. Mm-hmm. So that to me has sort of been the amazing thing of how so many of these soldiers are now connected with the Marshallese over this same issue, and both are suffering from it.
Suzanne Rust is an investigative reporter with the Los Angeles Times, and you can find her pieces on the Marshall Islands at yourcallradio.org. Suzanne, thank you so much for your great reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. You can find more information about what we talked about today at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Calls One Planet series. On the next Your Call, we'll hear from young refugees who fled Central American countries in search of safety in the U.S. Several of these stories are captured as oral histories in the new book, Solito Solita, which means alone, alone. The narrators describe why they fled, what happened on their dangerous journeys, and for some, their struggles to survive in the U.S. Join the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.